Welcome to the March 2016 edition of Annotated Bibliography Podcast, also known as Journal Scan, or This Month in Other Journals besides the AJNR. I'm Jeff Ross, and for this edition, I've looked at 8 articles from the recent literature that I've found of some interest, and I hope you will find them of interest as well. As always, the references I'm discussing will be posted onto the AJNR blog for your convenience. The first paper has a first author of Brinjikji, and it is entitled Contemporary Carotid Imaging, From Degree of Stenosis to Plaque Vulnerability, and this was published in the Journal of Neurosurgery in 2016. This is a very nice and detailed review article on the various methods of evaluating carotid plaque. Topics covered include a review of histopathology and classification of plaque, MR imaging, CT, such as multi-detector row CT, dual source CT, and CTA, ultrasound, both B-mode and contrast enhanced, transcranial Doppler, and molecular imaging, such as FDG PET. There are 10 figures and 3 tables, so take a look at that if you're interested. The second paper has a first author of Eisenmenger, and it's entitled The Evolution of Diffusion-Weighted Magnetic Resonance Imaging Signal Abnormality in Sporadic Creutzfeldt-Jakob Disease with Histopathological Correlation, and this is from JAMA Neurology in 2015. This study is the largest to date to describe the evolution of MR signal on diffusion imaging in patients diagnosed as having sporadic Creutzfeldt-Jakob with histopathologic correlation. The authors found that disease progression is accompanied by an increase in the extent and intensity of signal abnormality in the basal ganglia. They evaluated gray matter involvement on diffusion imaging among 37 patients with Creutzfeldt-Jakob in 26 cortical and 5 subcortical subdivisions per hemisphere using a semi-quantitative scoring system at baseline and follow-up. They looked at age, disease duration, atrophy, codon 129 methionine valine polymorphism, Medical Research Council rating scale score, and histopathologic findings. 59 of 62 regions showed increased signal intensity at follow-up, the greatest within the caudate and putamen. They conclude that diffusion in the basal ganglia may provide a non-invasive biomarker of disease severity for future therapeutic trials. There are 6 graphs and 1 MR imaging set in the paper. The third paper has a first author of Fennell, and it is entitled Morbidity and Mortality of Patients with Endovascularly Treated Intracerebral Aneurysms. Does Physician Specialty Matter? That's from Journal of Neurosurgery in 2016. The authors conducted a retrospective analysis of a database, the University Health System Consortium, from 2009 to 2013. Outcome measures of morbidity and mortality were evaluated according to the specialty of the treating physician in patients with endovascularly obliterated unruptured aneurysms and those with subarachnoid hemorrhage. For patients treated with an unruptured aneurysm, 12,400, patients with at least one complication were reported in about 6.5%. Deaths were reported in 193, which is 1.6%. The highest incidence of complications, 11%, and deaths, 3%, were reported by neurologists. The fewest complications were reported by neurosurgeons at 5.4%. For subarachnoid hemorrhage patients, 8,197 of them, at least one complication was reported in about 29% and deaths in 12%. The highest incidence of complications, that would be 34%, and deaths, 13%, in subarachnoid hemorrhage was in cases performed by neurologists. The fewest complications were in cases by neurosurgeons, 27%. Interventional radiologists fell in the middle for both patient groups. They conclude that there was a statistically significant finding that neurosurgically trained physicians demonstrate improved outcomes with respect to endovascular treatment of unruptured aneurysms in this cohort. They state that lower complication and mortality rates for neurosurgeons is compelling and warrants further investigation. As a follow-up to that, the fourth paper has a first author of Montanera, and it's the editorial, and it's titled, Does Physician Specialty Matter? It's also from Journal of Neurosurgery in 2016. In this measured editorial regarding that Fennell paper, Dr. Montanera outlines several difficulties drawing conclusions from that initial paper, such as the limitations of the database are many and the analysis is retrospective. Institutions or individuals self-report to the database, and a complication is not really defined or detailed. There is no data allowing comparison of the patients, age, comorbidities, subarachnoid hemorrhage grading, or the aneurysms treated, such as size, location, and neck width. No data is provided concerning the procedure volumes for the treating centers. So in the end, Dr. Montanera asked the big question, how do we optimize training for endovascular practitioners of the future? And certainly having a reliable data would be a nice start in that. The fifth paper has a first author of Fu, and it is entitled Comparison of Agreement of Cervical Spine Degenerative Pathology Findings in Magnetic Resonance Imaging Studies, and this is from the Spine Journal in 2015. This is a retrospective study of 48 patients who underwent routine cervical spine MR at the author's institution between 2011 and 2012. A panel of two orthopedic spine surgeons and four musculoskeletal radiologists independently reviewed 48 sets of T2-weighted axial and sagittal MR sequences for a series of pre-selected criteria, and their findings were compared to those of the other panelists to determine the inter-rater agreement. Absolute inter-rater agreement ranged from 54% to 95%. Disc hydration was around 54%, central stenosis at 72%, and foraminal stenosis 73%. They demonstrated the lowest inter-rater agreement. Spondylolisthesis had a good agreement at 95% and cord signal change at 93%. They conclude that physicians should be aware of inconsistencies in interpretation of cervical MR findings and should be aware that some findings demonstrate lower agreement than others. The discussion is a nice review of the literature, showing other investigators have also found this wide variation in findings for central stenosis and for foraminal stenosis. Paper number 6 has the first author of Leslie Mazwi, and it is entitled Endovascular Stroke Treatment Outcomes After Patient Selection Based on Magnetic Resonance Imaging and Clinical Criteria. This is from JAMA Neurology in 2015. This is a single-center prospective cohort study evaluating 72 patients with middle cerebral artery or terminal internal carotid artery occlusion by CTA, followed by core infarct volume determination by diffusion MR, who underwent thrombectomy. Patients were prospectively classified as either likely to benefit or uncertain to benefit using diffusion-weighted imaging lesion volume and clinical criteria such as age, NIH stroke scale, time from onset, baseline modified Rankin scale, and life expectancy. 40 patients were prospectively classified as likely to benefit and 32 as uncertain to benefit. Reperfusion and prospective categorization as likely to benefit were associated with favorable outcomes. They conclude that selection of patients using MR compares favorably with selection using CT techniques, with the distinction that a higher proportion of screened patients were treated using MR. So what defined the likely to benefit group? All these criteria had to be met. Number one, age younger than 80. 2. Time from stroke onset or last seen well to the time of groin puncture of less than 6 hours. Premorbid baseline Rankin of 1 or less and life expectancy greater than 12 months. And 4. Diffusion volume less than 70 ml. The uncertain to benefit had, as you might expect, age of 80 or greater, time from stroke onset of 6 to 8 hours, premorbid Rankin of 2 to 3, and a diffusion volume of 70 to 100 ml. The theory is that patients with a clinical deficit and small core infarct volume, despite a proximal vessel occlusion, must have excellent collateral circulation. So a threshold diffusion volume of less than 70 has been used to improve outcomes in patients with acute stroke treated endovascularly, and this was also used in the DIFFUSE 2 trial, first author of Landsberg. DIFFUSE 2 study investigators MRI profile in response to endovascular reperfusion after stroke. That was in Lancet Neurology in 2012. So the seventh paper has a first author of MOC, and it is entitled Modic Changes of the Lumbar Spine, Prevalence, Risk Factors, and Association with Disc Degeneration and Low Back Pain in a Large-Scale Population-Based Cohort. That's from the Spine Journal in 2015. Sagittal T2 MRs of the lumbar spine were assessed for the presence of modic changes and other spinal phenotypes, disc degeneration, disc displacement, Schmorl's nodes, in 2,449 Southern Chinese volunteers. The subjects' demographics, occupation, lifestyle, and clinical profiles were assessed. Overall prevalence of modic changes was 5.8%, 141, which increased with age. Modic changes at 4.5 and L5-S1 were associated with age, Schmorl's nodes, disc degeneration or displacement, and a history of lumbar injury. The presence of modic changes at the lower lumbar levels were associated with a history of low back pain and correlated with disc degeneration. I'd say it is notable that because the study was originally designed to assess disc degeneration, only T2 weighted images were available, so there's not really any differentiation of the subtypes of modic changes in this study. Number 8 has a first author of Srivastava, and it is entitled Single Stage Anterior Release and Posterior Instrumented Fusion for Irreducible Atlantoaxial Dislocation with Basilar Invagination. And this is from the Spine Journal in 2016. This is a retrospective case series of 19 patients surgically treated for irreducible atlantoaxial dislocation. The surgeries consisted of an anterior release done via a transoral approach in 12 patients and a retropharyngeal approach in 7. Following the anterior release, all patients underwent posterior instrumented fusion. Causes of the dislocation included occipitalization of the atlas in 16, osteodontoidium in 2, and a missing posterior elements of the axis in 1 patient. The anterior release is performed by cutting the bilateral longus coli and longus capitis muscles along with the anterior longitudinal ligament. If traction does not reduce the dislocation at this point, they then performed a subperiosteal stripping of the posterior pharyngeal wall to expose the C12 joint capsule, and then the capsule is opened and adhesions released. Then the patient again is put into traction to bring the odontoid into better alignment. Once that's done, then they go ahead and do the posterior fusion. Interesting technique, I would say, in the U.S., for somebody with severe anterior disease like that, the most likely surgery is going to be some type of transoral resection of the odontoid with posterior fixation. Obviously, this approach is a little bit less invasive because you're just at worst going after the joint capsule and then using traction to try to bring things into alignment. Well, that's all for this month. Thanks for sticking with me to the end of this. If you have any feedback on the podcast, let me know your criticisms of praise at ajnr.eic@gmail.com. And until next month with new papers, thanks so much for listening. Goodbye.